offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. And this is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, coming to you live from our studios at the Shri Satya Sai Media Center, Prashanthi Nilayam. And it gives me great pleasure to join you again on this journey where we go through the Bhagavad Gita verse by verse. We have completed 9 chapters. We started the 10th chapter last week. A very interesting chapter, and I'm sure you'll find some of the things that Lord Krishna is saying in the verses we're going to go through very interesting. But before we come to that part of the chapter, let's have a quick summary of what we covered last time. We started with an introduction to the chapter, as we always do. We saw that Krishna is going to speak more about himself. Why should Krishna speak more about himself? We saw how bhakti comes when we are able to, at least to a certain extent, understand and comprehend the glory of God. Because that way, the temptation of the world begins to pale in significance when we are able to look up to the glory of God. Right? So that's the whole idea. And why is bhakti necessary? Bhakti is a very important component of karma yoga. And as we've always maintained, that is the essential discourse that Krishna is giving Arjuna. Then we discussed why this chapter is given the name it is given. It is called Vibhuti Yoga, and what is the meaning of Vibhuti? Vibhuti in general means the glorious manifestations of the Lord. More specifically, Vibhuti is that manifestation of the Supreme that we can see all around us, see even within us, and through which we can perceive and recognize and thereby contemplate on the Lord, right? That's what is Vibhuti. Vibhu is the Lord, and Vibhuti is the expression of the Lord. That's what we had seen. The chapter itself starts with Krishna saying, in his own words, I will again explain about myself. So Krishna clearly stating that he's going to repeat himself, or rather emphasize a few points that he has already made in the previous chapters. So he says that I'm going to tell you again about the Supreme, and the reason behind that is your hita, your benefit. I know that this will benefit you, or this will bring welfare to you, and that is why I'm speaking about it again, is what Krishna says in the very first verse. It is not because I revel in talking about myself, or I like to spread my own glory. That's not the approach that Krishna is taking. I am speaking again and again about myself because I find that that will benefit you. Krishna also adds, it is because, O Arjuna, I see that now you take delight in what I say. A clear change of heart in the way Arjuna is listening to Krishna. Initially, he was very upset. He was not in a frame of mind to listen. He was hoping that Krishna will tell him something that is encouraging his idea of what is right. But what Krishna was saying was something completely different from what he had expected. But now slowly Arjuna is turning around, and he's seeing Krishna's point and seeing the whole scenario around him in a different light. And he's beginning to take delight in what Krishna is saying. And that's what Krishna is acknowledging here. Why is Krishna himself speaking and not asking anybody else to speak about him? It is understood that knowing about the Lord is beneficial. But why should Krishna himself speak about it? He could have probably asked some sage or some great yaksha or deva to speak about him. That again Krishna explains in the second verse. He says, because no one else knows me completely. No deva, no rishi, no great mahatma can speak about me, because they all have been created by me and their knowledge of me is only limited. They are not capable of revealing the entire glory. So that is why Krishna himself takes upon this task of speaking about his glory. The third shloka, Krishna reiterates the value of this knowledge. He says, "He who knows me, the birthless, the beginningless, and the Lord of all the worlds, he, such a person, becomes an undiluted one among the mortals and becomes freed from all sins." So those are the introductory verses, the first three verses, where Krishna says what he is going to say, and he is acknowledging that it is going to be a repetition. But why is he still going forward in saying it? Because it is going to benefit the listener, here Arjuna, and all of us too. And thirdly, why is he himself saying it? And that also is explained. And what is the ultimate benefit of listening to what Krishna is going to say here? He is saying that you will become undiluted and eventually it will free you from all sins, which means it has the capacity to take you to the ultimate goal, which is the ultimate hita that one person can have. So those are the three verses. We probably will have time only to go through two more verses today, because what Krishna says in these two verses, they merely seem like many words put together, but each one of those words is important. And it is important for us to dwell into each one of those words, because Krishna says, if you acknowledge that this is a vibhuti of mine, then you will be able to recognize me as you go through life, as you experience your everyday living. You should be able to look at these qualities and say, ah, these are manifestations of my Swami. These are manifestations of the Lord. So that is why we will dwell deeply into each one of those words that Krishna makes. As I mentioned towards the end of last week's episode, verses 4 and 5 have to be spoken of together. So I will play the fourth verse. As always, the verses have been rendered beautifully and clearly in Brother Shyam's voice. I will play verse number 4. I will give you a brief meaning of that. I'll play verse number 5, give you a brief meaning of that. Then the rest of the episode, we're going to dwell deep into what Krishna says in these two verses. So we will listen to verse number 4 first, and then we'll take it from there.
Buddhirnyanamasam moha kshama satyam damashamaha sukham dukham bhavo bhavo bhayancha bhayamevacha.
Intelligence, knowledge, non-delusion, forbearance, truth, control of the external organs, control of the internal organs, happiness, sorrow, birth, death, and fear, as also fearlessness. That is the fifth verse. That's the fourth verse of the 10th chapter. We'll listen to the fifth verse. I'll give you a brief meaning of that as well.
Ahimsa samata tushtihi tapodanam yasho yashah bhavanti bhava bhutanam matta eva prithagvidha.
Non-injury, equanimity, satisfaction, austerity, charity, fame, infamy, or absence of fame, these different dispositions of beings spring from me alone. So that is the fifth verse and the fourth verse. I gave you the meaning, the simple meaning of whatever is said in both of these verses. As we were discussing last week, and as I had also mentioned in the summary that we started with, the theme of this chapter is Krishna reiterating that anything that is glorious, that is looked up upon, has to be seen as the vibhuti of the Lord, as a glorious expression of His presence. And by doing that, by recognizing all these adorable qualities as vibhuti, we can overcome anubhuti, the idea of limitedness, the idea of me being this individual, right? And also when you start recognizing all these as indications of God, it leads to devotion. Once you're able to recognize the Lord around, adoring Him, remembering Him, contemplating upon Him becomes very natural. So that's the whole idea. And to start with, Krishna mentions qualities that are associated with beings, bhutanam, qualities that we see in everyday life, qualities that we possess. Some of them we enjoy the benefits that we have gained from. Some of them, some of these things are very essential qualities to live life itself. The spectrum of these qualities will be from the most mundane to the supreme qualities that speak of what takes one sadhaka to the ultimate goal. So that's why in the end of the fifth verse, where Krishna speaks of all of these qualities, and then in the end, in the last line of the fifth verse, he says, Bhavanti bhava bhutanam matta eva prithag vidaha. Bhava bhutanam means qualities of beings. These are not heavenly qualities. These are not superhuman qualities. These are not vibhutis like omnipresence and omnipotence, or God's ability to manifest in different places at different times, or the ability to materialize. Some of these are miracles that we associate with divine powers, right? We've seen Swami perform many of these miracles, jaw-dropping miracles. We've seen Swami resurrecting the dead. We've heard of Swami materializing objects that you cannot even imagine. All of these are also vibhutis, but what we are talking of are bhava bhutanam, the qualities of beings which we fail to recognize as equally being vibhutis of the Lord. Or they are different kinds, right? That's what he says. Prithagvidaha. These are different kinds of qualities. Bhava bhutanam prithagvidaha. They are different kinds, and we will go through all of them shortly. But the most important thing is, he is saying, bhavanti matta eva. They all arise from me and me alone. That is the most important point to keep in mind. And each one of the points that Krishna mentions are to be contemplated upon, are to be recognized. And as we discussed last time, this contemplation loosens the grip of the ego. And when the grip of the ego is loosened, doership also begins to get sublimated. So let us see what are these various attributes that Krishna mentions. The first two in the fourth verse he said were buddhir jnanam. Buddhihi jnanaha. What is the difference between buddhi and jnana? Adi Shankara gives a very beautiful explanation in his commentary, and I think it is very relatable. Buddhi or intelligence is the ability to look at the subtle aspects of life. He says in his commentary, antakarnasya sukshmadyarthava bhodana samarthyam. The ability of the antakarna, the inner instruments, the mind, to see that which is sukshma, not directly visible to buddhi. Not directly visible to the senses, that is buddhi. And a person who possesses this ability to see these subtle connections, these subtleties in life, is referred to as a buddhiman or an intelligent one. If you look at it, this is probably the best definition of intelligence itself. What is science? It is nothing but the study of patterns and subtle connections, isn't it? We are able to see the connection between the change in the phases of the moon, and we are able to correlate that to the changes in the tides. We are able to see patterns in which subatomic particles interact, and with that knowledge of how what happens in this tiniest of things. We are able to sense what is happening in far-off planets and stars, or what happens in the core of the sun, where we have no direct view of these things. Or I listen to a song and I'm able to make out the raga in which the song is composed. I eat a dish and I'm able to make out the ingredients in that dish, or the process that must have been used to make that or cook that dish. We used to have a calculus teacher in school, you know, who was very, very fond of mathematics. And when he used to especially teach calculus and all that, you could see that gives him so much joy, right? So many times when he's teaching, for some time he will be lost in wonderment. Imagine he just freezes, his eyes are gazing into something distant, and there will be a beautiful, blissful smile on his face. And then he'll turn to us and see, wow, do you see it? Do you see it? How beautiful the concept is. Most of us could not see it. We could not have the same joy, because we were not able to see what he was able to see. And he was able to see because of his buddhi, of his intelligence. He was able to see a beautiful pattern in all these concepts, right? That is what it is. And when we do, when we are able to see that, we will be filled with that same joy. That ability to see the unseen comes from intelligence. And everything comes under this: art, music, economics, sociology, biology, medicine, philosophy, psychology, name it. These are all a result of this ability of the mind to see subtle patterns and connections. And every time you're able to do that, as I said, you're probably doing it when you're tasting a dish, or you're listening to a bhajan and you're able to identify the raga, or something like that, anything which is not obvious, but you have the ability to see the connections and you're able to see what is beyond what the senses perceive. Every time that you're able to do that, it is an expression of buddhi, and that buddhi is a vibhuti of the Lord. That is why Krishna says, I am buddhi, then comes jnana. I am buddhi, I am jnanam. That which is gathered through this ability to see the subtle things, that is jnana, isn't it? Buddhi is the ability to see patterns, and when you're able to see those patterns, the body of knowledge that you gain is what is referred to as jnana. The knowledge of these various fields, like art or science, I become a scientist. I become a scientist when I'm able to see the subtle patterns. Probably I become a material scientist when I'm able to see the subtle patterns in crystals and in materials, isn't it? Or how do we build our vocabulary? First, we make the connection between the alphabet and the phonetic, then words and their meanings, then the ability to put them in a sentence to convey a certain meaning. And using this ability to correlate words to their meanings, we further build our knowledge. That makes us knowledgeable. So using this ability to make connections and see subtle patterns and connections, we build our repository of knowledge. And we become knowledgeable in the process in that particular field. There is also another way of looking at it. Let us take the example of sciences, a science like cosmology, for example. Today, we know much, much more than we knew 100 years ago in that particular field, or take any science for that matter, physics or geography or geology or anything for that matter. What we know today as humanity is much, much more than what we knew 100 years ago. I'm sure all of you will agree with that. Is it that we have created more knowledge about these fields? Yes, we have more written books. Yes, we have more body of work like research papers and so on and so forth. We probably have better images. We have better diagrams that are more accurate. But have we created any new information, or have we revealed more information through the process of study? So when there is an object, all knowledge about that knowledge, about that object is created along with that object. Using my intellect, using my buddhi, or our collective buddhi as humanity, we only reveal that knowledge slowly. So when God creates an object or a phenomenon, or in general the entire creation, all knowledge about it is also created along with it. Using our buddhi, we only reveal that knowledge bit by bit. So doesn't that mean that all knowledge we have, we possess, be it a small knowledge or comprehensive knowledge about a topic, is nothing but a result of our exploration that is also God-given? So that's why Krishna says, I am buddhi, the ability to see that which is unseen. And with this buddhi, the knowledge that you collect, that is also me, because I have only created that knowledge too. Today you understand it. Yesterday, when I was a 10-year-old kid, I did not understand some things. As a 20-year-old, as a 30-year-old, as a 40-year-old, I'm unable to understand. It only means I am revealing more of the knowledge which was already there, or I am opening my eyes to the knowledge which is already there. So all knowledge has its source in the Lord. That is how God is buddhir jnanam. The next is asammohaha, non-delusion or clarity as to what is what. Krishna says, I am asammohaha. With knowledge, we are able to see things as they are. I see a rainbow in the sky. I will not run after it as though it is an object that I can take it, I can catch and take it home with me. Because I know that it is nothing but a dispersion of light. So I'm not deluded into thinking that it is something else. It is something that I can put away in my attic as my possession. So I am not deluded into thinking it is something else. Like that, there are many things that we have taken for granted. We don't run after them. We are not afraid of them or not disturbed because there is knowledge. We are not afraid of our shadow. It is because we have knowledge as to what is that phenomenon. When there is a thunder, it feels like the entire sky is falling on us. But we don't fear, or we don't fear it that way, that the skies are going to fall on us, because we have knowledge as to what that thunder is, what that lightning is. So that clarity of thinking, without which we probably cannot do anything in life, that clarity is a vibhuti of the Lord, is what Krishna is beautifully stating here. Now when we speak of knowledge and non-delusion, jnana and asammohaha, the ultimate expression of these two is self-knowledge and atmajnana. Self-knowledge or atmajnana and complete release from maya, isn't it? What Krishna is speaking here, speaking of jnana and asammohaha, the ultimate expression of that is atmajnana and complete release from all delusion or maya. We defined atmajnana as that in one of the earlier chapters, I think in the second chapter itself that comes. Seeing the tattva or the self as it is, the world as it is what is referred to as absolute knowledge. There is no moha after that. You see atma as atma, you see anatma as anatma, there is no delusion. And that discrimination that is associated with this jnana and this sammoha is what is referred to as spiritual buddhi or spiritual intellect, the nitya anitya viveka buddhi. That discrimination that enables us to separate the eternal from the ephemeral. Nitya anitya viveka buddhi. So what Krishna is saying here is, from simple buddhi, starting with I eat something and I'm able to make out what that thing I'm eating is. Nobody needs to tell me that. That is also buddhi. That buddhi leading to knowledge, be it knowledge of music, be it knowledge of dance, be it knowledge of science, be it knowledge of literature, that jnana leading to asammoha, which gives us a clarity of thought as to what is what in life. We don't run after the wrong things. We don't delude ourselves. We will make fools of ourselves if we do that. If I start fearing my shadow, if I start running after a mirage or a rainbow. So even to be a normal person in this world, we need this buddhi, jnana and asammoha. So starting from that buddhi, jnana, asammoha to the ultimate viveka buddhi, atma jnana and moha kshaya, which is what is referred to as moksha. Swami says this entire range is a vibhuti of the Lord. I think that is a very profound thing that Krishna is saying. The simplest of knowledge that you have, you should look at it and say, this is a miracle of the Lord. Similarly, the ultimate jnana is also an expression of His glory. Swami says, one of the fundamental mischief played by the mind is called avarana. It completely hides the truth of the self and the nature of the world, right? The example that Swami would give is the mind is like a mirror and avarana is like when you put a thick black cloth over it. That is one of the flaws of the mind. The mind does not, though it is supposed to be a mirror, it doesn't show you what things are as they are. And this avarana, Swami says, is made up primarily of mada or pride. And this pride is of 8 types. 2 of which is secular knowledge and spiritual knowledge. Learning and spiritual attainment. Swami says, even these 2 lead to pride. And especially when speaking to students, Swami would often emphasize this point, that with education, when you come from a background, if you're a first generation student, or even if you're coming from an educated family, you end up studying more than the rest of the people in your household or the larger family. You're a PhD, you're a double graduate, you're a professional. Swami would say that all of this will lead to some sort of a pride. You'll feel that, oh, I'm greater than everybody else. It is very important to counter that. And why is it important to counter that? Because that pride becomes an avarana and that leads to delusion. So the way to counter that is to recognize all these forms of buddhi, all these forms of knowledge and all forms of clarity that we enjoy in life are an expression of the Lord's glory. Then Krishna goes on to speak about other qualities. He says, kshama, forgiveness or forbearance, is a vibhuti of the Lord. Again, a quality that is mundane, at the same time, supremely spiritual. Without kshama, we cannot live in society at all. One of the things that we used to be told in school, you may recall this statement, man is a social animal. Right? Oftentimes we go through that in our science when we study in the early classes. Man is a social animal. It is impossible to be a social animal if we cannot tolerate each other, isn't it? We cannot achieve anything if we cannot bear pain, if we cannot bear delays, if we cannot put up with obstacles. Swami has spoken at length on kshama and I've quoted some of it earlier too on the series. We will not go into all of that. But kshama is a quality of that defines maturity, right? Without kshama, there is no maturity at all. A person who gets perturbed with every small issue is called an immature person. And the person who has kshama of the highest order is considered a mahatma, a noble person, right? That ability to forgive, that ability to put up with something which is not likable to you is what is referred to as kshama. A similar quality is going to be mentioned again. We'll come to that when we come to that. But when you talk about kshama and that being a noble quality, I'm reminded of a very beautiful episode from the life of Sant Eknath. Sant Eknath is supposed to be somebody who epitomized this kshama, the ability of forgiving people and not being perturbed by their actions. And in fact, it was almost superhuman. People recognized him as a saint because of his ability to not get angry at all. So there were always people around him who thought that, you know, if you test him enough, probably he'll lose his temper. And, you know, there'll always people who are envious and jealous when you get a status like that, when people start recognizing you. So there were these people in his village who wanted to see, you know, how much he can hold himself together. And if you really trouble him enough, he might lose his cool. So they would keep trying different ways in which they could incite him. So one day they caught hold of a man and said that we will pay you if you go and spit on Eknath Maharaj. And this man said, why do you want me to do that? They said, no, we want to make him angry. And if you succeed in making him angry by doing this, we will pay you a hefty sum, or we'll give you a handsome amount of money. So this man, who probably was in need of that money, decided that he'll do that. And this man thought that, you know, which is the best time to do this so that Eknath Maharaj is likely to get angry. So he says that just after he has had his dip in the river, after he has finished his bath, when he is coming towards his house, I will do that. Right? That's the time when you're likely to become most irritated, when somebody defiles you when you've just had your bath. And that's precisely what he does. He spits just as Eknath Maharaj comes after his holy dip in the river. And when he does that, the saint shows no signs of getting upset. He smiles, again goes back into the river, takes another dip and comes. This man is surprised, but he does it again. He again spits on the saint. Again, Eknath Maharaj smiles and goes back into the river, takes a dip and comes. And this scene of Eknath Maharaj taking a dip and coming and this man spitting on him happens again and again and again, not once, not twice, not five times, not 10 times. It happens 107 times. And when Eknath Maharaj comes out after his 108th dip in the water, this man finally comes and falls prostrate at his feet and he says, please forgive me, oh Maharaj, this is a really wrong thing I've done. Because he comes to the understanding that if somebody has this kind of tolerance, this kind of kshama, this person can be only an incarnation of God or a manifestation of his glory. And fearing that he will be cursed, he falls at his feet and he says, please forgive me. And he explains the whole thing, that, you know, somebody promised me money if I incite you, and that is why I did all this. I was ill-advised. Then Eknath Maharaj looks at him with pity and he says, what is there to forgive you for this? I was only thinking what a glorious day it is today that God allowed me to take 108 sacred dips in the river. So I just remembered that story. When you talk about the quality of kshama, when you talk of it as something that is required in everyday life, that kshama is also an expression of God. This sort of supreme kshama, when you look at it in a person, when you see that in a person, you immediately say, oh my God, this is a divine trait. This is a saintly trait. Even that is an expression of God. It is easy to recognize a kshama of this order that someone like Eknath Maharaj embodied and say that this is a manifestation of the Supreme. But we forget that every day when we put up with the people around us, that quality is also a vibhuti of the Lord. After kshama, Krishna mentions few more traits that are simple in the sense that we cannot live without these. And at the same time, as I said, they are also signs of maturity and also the highest expression in the sign. In their highest expression, they are signs of spiritual wisdom itself. The first of that is Satya or truth. Satya is a representation of God, is something that we all cannot debate, we will not disagree with. But here Satya refers to simple truth, purely based on the other qualities that Krishna is mentioning here. Satya represents the ability to speak of things as they are seen or as they are experienced. Again, it's a quality that is not given much importance. Well, speaking truth is given importance, I'm not denying that. We always teach that that is a virtue, and Satyam Vada Dharmam Chara, we always give importance to spoken truth. What I meant by saying that it is not given importance is, how much of this quality of the ability to speak what I have seen or what I have heard or what I have experienced defines our life, but we don't acknowledge it enough. To be able to express in words what has been experienced is itself an advanced ability that we have taken for granted. I was once reading this book on human evolution, and they mention what a huge role this ability has played in the progress of the human race. In animal societies, when animals come together and live as groups, communication was used mainly for two things, right? Among the many other things, two important things which meant life or death. To warn the group about a danger that was approaching, and to inform the group about the availability of food or certain resources. Some would often say this, you know, an ant finds a piece of sugar or a piece of jaggery, it tastes it and then it goes back to its colony and it informs that, you know, I found a source of food, and all the ants come and take it. Same is the case with every group of animals, be it a group of chimpanzees or a group of lions. They would often inform the group about a predator that is approaching or a danger that is approaching, or come and inform the group that there is resources available in this place, let us go towards that. And this is seen in most animal groups. But the ability to express the nature of that information or to provide more details was not to be seen in most of these animal races. But in the human race, as man progressed and developed language, he could come back to his group and clearly say, what is that danger? How far is that danger? And giving more vital information that helped them prepare better for that danger that was approaching. Or say when some resources are seen, a pool of water is seen, or there, you know, there are a meadow or a field of grass that can be used as food. The animals would come back and say that I found food. That's all they could communicate. But man, with his advanced abilities to speak and describe, could come back and say, how much is available? What is the experience in the route that is to be taken to reach that resource? How many of us need to go? Is it good enough for the entire group, or is that only a limited source? All of these descriptions could be given. So when we talk about Satya, this Satya that we are referring to in the most common and mundane expression is the ability to express in words what has been experienced through the senses in a manner that you cannot create an image that is useful to the person listening to those words. And the ability is already very advanced in human beings. Even when you're talking about a normal person, a worldly person, I'm not even talking about spirituality, about sadhana and all of that, right? Not only can we describe a scene to each other, we even have the ability to describe an idea or a philosophy which does not have a form. I am reading something, I am understanding a concept, and with words I am trying to describe to you what I have understood. And with the hope that I am able to create the same understanding in your mind, isn't it? I am this ability is so advanced that I can have an understanding in my mind, and with words I can transfer that understanding to your mind, and we are not even looking at each other. We are not even sitting across the table. Or something as simple as I can eat an ice cream or a pizza and I can come and describe it to you, and you will have a fair idea of how that is. Of course, there is no, there is no way the words can describe what the other senses experience. But you can have a fair idea of that transference of experience, isn't it? A rock or a mineral, if you look at it, has no ability to convey an experience. We would often say this when we were students: if only the walls of Swami's interview room could speak, if only they could write or express in words what they would have witnessed in these past so many decades, imagine the Bhagavatam that it would produce. And sadly, it cannot, unless Swami decides to give that ability to those walls. So a wall or a rock or an inanimate object has zero ability to express what has been experienced. If you look at plants and some other lower life forms, maybe they can share information through a chemical process, right? Ants communicate with each other with pheromones. You have plants that communicate with each other through other chemicals. But when you come to the human beings, there is language. This ability to speak what has been experienced as it is, or as best as one remembers it, is an ability, a divine ability through which God shines. And we've spoken about this before. God exists equally in the mineral as he exists in the human. But the expression of that divinity is increasingly more and more in the human state. And this satya is also a sign of that evolution, of that maturity in evolution, right? From mineral to animal, from animal to human, and within human beings also, it comes with, it is a sign of maturity. It calls for a certain strength of character to be truthful, isn't it? To be able to speak things as they are. And at the same time, the ultimate expression of this truth is to see and experience the truth behind the world. This entire spectrum, starting from simply being able to express in words what has been experienced, to the ability to see things as they are, the truth, the ultimate tattva darshanam as we speak, this entire gamut of experiences comes under satya, and you can experience God in that simplest of the act. You can experience God in that supreme expression of the satya. The next two qualities Krishna mentions are dama shamaha. Dama and shama. And these are two qualities that are closely related, and that is why in many scriptures you will find them always being mentioned together. Dama means control of the external organs. We all get angry, but we don't always pounce on everyone whenever we get angry. Or we don't simply speak whatever comes to our mind. We practice a certain amount of restraint. You cannot practice kshama or forbearance without having control over your physical body, isn't it? And just like how we saw in satya, in speech, control over the body is most essential for simple living. The very act of standing on 2 feet, which we've taken for granted, in evolution that calls for enormous dhamma, isn't it? If you read anthropology, they'll tell you that the ability of the Homo sapiens to stand erect has come over enormous amount of evolution. So when we talk about kshama, it even includes that. Imagine a medical condition even today, like muscular dystrophy or something like that, or paralysis, where there is wasting away of muscles. one cannot stand with balance. One cannot sit with balance. One cannot walk from one point to the other without wobbling. When we look at such people, it should remind us that God's glory is Vibhuti is working through me and I am able to stand. I am able to walk normally. I can pick up a glass of water and drink when I am thirsty. I am able to sit erect for an hour and I am able to speak. The point I am making is, see how many everyday experiences there are where God's grace shines through our every moment of life, which we have taken for granted. And when we take them for granted, it is an opportunity that we have lost to recognize, acknowledge, and experience God. Isn't it? So Dhamma is required for simple living in society, and sometimes you need an advanced form of that ability too. When we talk about austerities, we'll come to that. When we talk about advanced disciplines, without Dhamma, you cannot do anything. Swami would say, I've quoted that experience many times before, when a student asked about, Swami, how do I control my mind? Swami said, first start with controlling the body. Learn to sit still. Learn to walk without, you know, looking here and there. Learn to look at a person in the eye when you're speaking to that person. All of these physical qualities, physical control is nothing but Dhamma, and all spiritual sadhana starts with controlling the body. So all of that comes under Dhamma. So something as simple as the ability to do what we want with the body, I want to pick up food and put it into my mouth, that requires Dhamma. The ability to sit and meditate, that also requires Dhamma. And all this Dhamma is nothing but an expression of the glory of God. Then comes Shama, which is control of the inner qualities or inner equipment, control of the mind, antakarnas. Again, something which is so normal that we miss. When we spoke about meditation, we had discussed this. You simply observe your thoughts, and when you find that your thoughts are going astray, we very gently bring them back to what we are meditating upon. Is that act possible if we do not have control over the mind? We all say that, oh, I have no control over the mind just thinks whatever it wants. That's true. Many thoughts are spontaneous, but we do have Shama. We don't acknowledge that enough. Or on a random day, we start thinking of something negative, or we think of some person and our thoughts are going all over the place and we're thinking all kinds of negative things about that person. And suddenly we say, no, why am I thinking like this? I should not be having such thoughts. These thoughts are wrong. And we are able to pull our thoughts back. And instantly we are able to draw our mind back and think of something else. We do have this ability, right? If we do not have this ability, we would have gone mad. In mental illness, that's what happens. People lose control over their thoughts. Or when somebody has a panic attack, or when a person goes into a clinical depression, they lose the ability to control the mind. Which means 99% of the time when we are normal, when we are able to concentrate, we have Shama, and that is a vibhuti of the Lord. Swami would say, you need concentration for everything. To drive a car, you need concentration. To read a book, to cook, to stitch, to write, for everything you need concentration. This is possible because God's miracle is shining through us in the form of Shama. Shama is a vibhuti of the Lord. And how is Dhamma and Shama related? Sometimes we control the expression of thoughts without them becoming actions. And sometimes we are able to control the thoughts themselves. Control of the expression of thoughts is Dhamma. Control of the thoughts themselves is Shama. And the same Dhamma and Shama is required for the ultimate state of Samadhi too, right? That's what happens when you're able to sit and completely lose body consciousness. That is the highest expression of this Shama and Dhamma. Till now, Krishna spoke about certain qualities, which I also explained as being positive qualities. Satya, Dama, Shama, all of that can be spoken of as positive qualities very easily. Even if you don't look at them as mundane qualities, it's very easy to look at them as glorious qualities. Next, Krishna mentions three pairs of qualities where they are the opposites of each other too. And that's going to be quite interesting. He says, Sukham Dukham Bhavaha Abhavaha Bhayam Cha Abhayam Cha Eva Bhayam Cha Abhayam Eva Cha. So he says, Sukham Dukham Bhavaha Abhavaha Bhayam and Abhayam. So you can see they're all pairs of opposites. And he says, I am both. First he says, all sukha or happiness comes from me. We've spoken about this. Sukha is the quality of the Atma. No object in the world can give happiness. Happiness only always comes from within. All events and things outside only act as a trigger that triggers the happiness from within. As Swami would say, like the dog that is chewing a dry bone, isn't it? The ability to feel joy always comes from the God within. Someone might make us happy. Some success may give us joy. Someone helping may fill us with hope. At a time when we need a lot of help, someone comes and helps us. It fills us with a lot of hope and joy. Every time we feel such joy, can we remind ourselves that that moment, that joy that we are experiencing is an expression of God? Is Swami's vibhuti, is Swami's miracle at that moment? In fact, without that sukha, there is no life at all. Isn't it? There is no life without sukha at all. We speak of sukha as the ultimate goal of life. But if we don't find sukha in everyday life, there is no life at all. We cannot live, isn't it? So that is very easy to understand the role of sukha, and that joy that you feel in everyday life when you accomplish something, when you eat something, when you do something, when somebody comes and gives you a form of happiness, that is also an expression of God. That ultimate sukha that we are all after, that is nothing but God revealing himself completely. There are no veils between that sukha and us. So that is easy to comprehend. But why is Krishna saying, I am dukkha too? He says, sukham dukkham. Why is he saying he is even dukkham? If Arjuna had not been sorrowful, he would not have turned to Krishna and asked him to explain all of this, isn't it? Victories did give him happiness. He had won many battles before. He was a great warrior. All those victories gave him happiness. But today when he was standing right ready for this battle, he suddenly feels that this victory is not capable of making me happy. On the contrary, this victory will make me sad. It will give me pain. And that dukkha is what made him ask some fundamental questions in life. If we get all happiness that we seek from the world, we will never turn within. So God has purposely put pain and suffering in the world so that we will not get attached to it. Krishna had said in the previous chapter, Anityam Asukham Lokam Imam Prapya Bhajaswamam. Who made this world Anityam and Asukham? Who has created the world in this manner? It is Anityam and Asukham. The same Lord who made it beautiful, and seeing which beauty we have to be reminded of him, also put pain in this world so that experiencing which we will remember him and we will turn within and seek the truth. When we see a beautiful artwork, a beautiful sculpting or a beautiful painting, what skill that artist had has become that painting, right? We will remember the skill of the artist when we see the beauty of that artwork. Dukkha is also a beautiful feature of this world. When we experience it, we should say, wow, what a skillful artist God is. He created dukkha. We should be able to recognize dukkha also as a vibhuti of Bhagwan. That is the highest expression of devotion, isn't it? So sukha, when we feel small happiness in life, that is also a miracle of the Lord. When we feel sorrow, that is also a miracle of the Lord. Bhavaha, birth or existence is a vibhuti. Nothing comes into existence with our effort, be it a small project or be it giving birth to another being. We look at our children and say, I gave birth to you. A child was born from the body of the mother. I mean, what better reason can there be for a mother to look at a child and say that I gave birth to you, I created you, literally. But is the mother really creating that being? What education or knowledge is enabling her to accomplish that task? For that matter, every lesser form that we see is also having that ability to create a being. It calls for no skill, it calls for no knowledge. So that ability is a God-given ability. It is not a trait that we have acquired, isn't it? What a real wonder it is that a form is born from another form. How is that possible without God's glory? A fetus that literally grows like a vestigial organ suddenly springs to life and becomes a being of its own. That bhavaha, that coming into existence, is a vibhuti of the Lord. It should fill us with awe. My God, this is a miracle. This is Swami making his appearance here. When you walk through a garden, when you see a simple flower, when you see a fruit, when you see a bird hatching an egg, all these are God's miracles. It is happening every day around us. But all of us are too busy to take note of that, isn't it? We say, Swami, when will you show your presence to us? We always look for him in the extraordinary, right? In some miraculous happening, we look for him. But here is Krishna saying, I am in everything. There's nothing wrong in looking for him in the extraordinary. But in the course of that pursuit, we are missing him in the ordinary. We are missing him in the simple things that we encounter every day. So he is bhavaha. He is abhavaha too. Birth and even death is a glory of God. What a beautiful statement. Even the something going out of existence is also a vibhuti of the Lord. Something vanishing also is his glory. We find it so difficult to see God's glory in death and decay. But look at abhavaha as a feature or a blessing. Because of abhavaha, pain as a limited existence. Pain comes for some time and then it vanishes because it has abhavaha. Problems vanish because they have this quality of abhavaha built into them. All forms of release are an expression of this abhavaha. So you can see his glory in the disappearing of certain things also, right? And of course, with maturity, we will see God's miracle in death also. That will also come. Just like how dukkha was a feature God has put in the world to turn us within. Transience is also a quality put in the world by God. As I said, he has made the world anityam and asukham. Anityam is because of this abhavaha, this miracle of abhavaha. When Swami used to materialize some exquisite objects, let's say a big diamond or Lord Rama's ring or something like that, he would wave his hand and he would wave his hand a little, you know, with a little bigger wave than he would wave it for materializing a vibhuti. And then we will know that, oh, something special is coming. So that's a miracle for which Swami was catching our attention. But after he would materialize some exquisite object like this, which he cannot give it to a devotee, or which he is not likely to give it to a devotee, we will all be looking at it, wondering, how is Swami going to make it vanish? Once, I think, in my undergraduate, Swami in Thrai Vrindavan materialized the Chudamani of Mother Sita. is a huge gem, right? Or the center gem in the Chudamani or something like that. It was a huge gem, the size of a golf ball. Swami materialized that and went around showing it to all the students in Trai Vrindavan. And at the end of it, suddenly Swami said, okay, who wants it? Catch. Literally like that. He threw it and it just vanished in the mid-air. What he materializes, when he materializes, it is a miracle. When Swami dematerializes something, that is also a miracle. Bhavaha is a vibhuti of God. Abhavaha is also a vibhuti of God. There are many more things that Krishna has said. Just in these two shlokas, we have not completed them. I'm already running out of time. We'll continue the understanding of these two verses in the next episode 2, and we will take it forward from there. Thank you, dear listeners, for your patient listening and your company. It's a very, very beautiful chapter, as we can already see, but it is beautiful only when we are able to experience what we are trying to understand through these words. If we are able to experience God in our everyday life, if we are able to pause at all these mundane activities that we do every day and we are able to remember Swami, then this reading that I have done is worthwhile for me. This listening that you have done is worthwhile for you. So let us only pray to Swami that he makes that possible. I most humbly offer this at Bhagwan's lotus feet. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the next segment. Outside, inside, deep inside, I'll join you at 12 for the afternoon satsang. Till I meet you all next week, take care, keep safe. Jai Sai Ram.